I'm Mary Jo and I'm an alcoholic. I'm from Houston, Texas. No, I'm lying. Out-of-town speaker, and I'm actually from Salt Lake City, so, but I did get here from Houston, Texas. And that's where my drinking story ended. So, that's about it, and now I'm over my nerves. This is kind of like, I'm kind of a loud person anyway. I've never been really soft-spoken, and I'm slightly nervous. I'm not sure if it's because it's a see-through podium, or I just get nervous. And so for a girl who likes attention, it's really uncomfortable for me to have this much attention at one time. And when I drank, it was a lot better. So since I'm not drinking, I feel anxious. Sobriety. I got sober September 16th of 1985. And in fact, it was not in Houston, Texas. It was in a treatment center in Naples, Florida, that I actually went to for an eating disorder. And when I got there, they do the assessment, and I guess I scored really high for alcoholic and drug addict, and the drug screen indicated that right up front. And a couple things that they thought I was lying about was, did I take any pills? And I said, no. And they said, well, we found Valium in your urine drug screen. And I was like, well, I had two Long Island iced teas. I smoked a joint. I did cocaine day before yesterday. I don't remember any pills, you know. And I was like, what has that got to do with me being here for an eating disorder? I had a boatload of problems. But anyway, where to start? Betty reminded me there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. And I was kind of freaked out because I like sharing for about 10, 15 minutes, and then I'd hurry up and get it done. I guess it's good for me to get to tell you my story. I think that's the thing I thought about today as I was, went through that. What am I going to say? How am I going to say it? Can I say everything I, want to make sure I get to say? And the truth is the best thing I have is the fact that I have been able to stay sober since that day that I went into treatment. And mostly and fully attribute that to my relationships with the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Understanding what the steps are as guidelines in my life and having lots of people to help me do it. Because there's no way I could have figured it out on my own. But that wasn't how it started. I actually grew up in Cincinnati. So I came from a family where I was the oldest of four kids. And a family where alcoholism was present, but it didn't look that messy. Until you get sober, it never looks that messy. And it was when I went to treatment for the eating disorder, nobody was admitting alcoholism in our family. And my mom and dad, I think I had called my mom up a couple times and told, when I was, drinking and doing some coke and told her. And she's in Ohio and I'm in Texas. That's when, some people started to get concerned. Because before then, I think I probably started any kind of substance use when I was 14. I was thinking about the first time I ever drank, hung around the kids in the neighborhood, and we found a six-pack of Rolling Rock beer in the woods. And we thought it was like, oh my God, this is so cool. So I think, before I even started drinking, I don't think I was born an alcoholic, but the thing that helps me understand that I am alcoholic is I liked the idea of drinking before I even drank. And some of what my parents would do is they'd have these cocktail parties when I was growing up, and everybody would come over and they'd all have wine and they would all drink. And I remember we'd always manipulate someone to bring us up the cashews to come up and visit us. I think we just kind of grew up in an environment that was pretty open, and alcohol just looked like fun. So I never really saw alcoholism be destructive. So when I got started at 14, I was basically just looking to have fun. I have no idea if we drank that Rolling Rock or not. What I do remember was the first blackout. I was a Girl Scout, and I don't remember what year, but I was probably 12 or 13, and a friend of mine, Beth Cushman, and I, we stole a good-sized bottle of Lancer's red wine from her mom's house, who was our Girl Scout leader. And we went up to my house so we wouldn't get in trouble. And between the two of us, I don't think we drank the whole bottle, but what my mom, I remember my mom and dad shaking both of us to find out what drugs we had done. And then finally my mom told me, you know, finally I had to convince my mom that we weren't doing drugs, and I went down and got the bottle of Lancer's behind the furnace. I mean, that is the very first time I can remember drinking. You know, naturally you black out when you have no tolerance and you drink too much. I don't remember if it was fun while I was drinking, but I remember it was fun getting the bottle, going and secretly drinking it. You know, I guess that was the beginning. I think by the time I got to like junior high, there was this, you know, you're around peers and you start to fit in, and drinking becomes looks like fun. I mean, again, it's just looking like fun, and I never had a second thought about it not being fun. And so drank throughout junior high, like that's a long time. I mean, you know what, we're talking like, you know, once a month. Or so. I mean, I was a good kid. I wasn't looking to get in trouble. And by the time I got into high school, things had started. You know, there's parties. You know, back in Ohio, we, you know, I think they have them everywhere. What, keggers? You go to a kegger, you drink lots of beer, you black out or throw up, and you had a great time. And, you know, and I just remember being with lots of people. And I think one of the things I do remember is that there was always a bit of insecurity about what people thought about me, how I would fit in, if I'd be liked. And it did make it easier to drink, anywhere from, you know, being down at the creek, hanging out with folks, drinking Strawberry Boone's Farm and Apricot Splash. Those are fun drinks. Straight out of the bottle, you know, not enough really to get drunk that I can remember. I just always had that association. And it wasn't just me. My sister and brother, who are both, my sister's a year and a half younger than I am, and my brother's 3 years younger. So there was the three of us that really kind of hung around a very similar crowd. I think my brother was just kind of always around. And my somewhere in high school, I convinced my parents to let my friends come to our house to party. And that meant, you know, drinking. That meant smoking pot. We were growing pot in the backyard. And I really think my parents, because of their own, I don't know if it was alcoholism, but just their own inexperience with how to be parents in charge, you got teenage kids just rolling over the top of you. And I think we did a real number on them. So I didn't grow up in a family where there was a lot of bad stuff that happened. There was chaos, though. And the chaos in my family was my dad would go on the wagon, because I don't remember he was much of a problem when he was drinking, but he was uptight when he wasn't. And I can remember that he would always announce it. And literally, he was the Catholic that went on the wagon for Lent, because you give up something you really like for Lent, and that was my dad. And he was irritable. And of course, my mother was a great Al-Anon, and, you know, she was, you know, pissed at, you know, all the little stuff that bugged her about what my dad did or didn't do. And so there would be, every now and then, be a blow-up where she'd get out of the car, or he'd do the tablecloth trick at dinner. And I just always had some anxiety about being okay if they weren't together. Kind of as the story goes, by the time I was 21, my party and was still progressing. I graduated high school at 18, and I tried 6 months of college, but I was loaded every day, and I really was in a lot of fear about having to show up and take tests and do homework, so I dropped out. I just said, it's a lot more fun to just party. Partying going to school wasn't something I really wanted to do. It was too much stress to do school. And so I went to work, and I supported myself. My parents asked me to pay rent, and I thought that was ludicrous, and so I moved out. And the other thing about moving out was I got to be on my own, and that was, you know, this independence that I think I'd been looking for. I don't want to say too much about the past, but at 21, my parents were finally figuring out that they shouldn't be together anymore. And I think that was a real heartbreak for me, but I had, rather than dealing with that, I had a better offer. My boyfriend had moved to Texas, and he said, come, you know, why don't you move down here? So at 21, really from a little town in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I lived out in the suburbs, so there was nothing about me being a city girl. I moved to Houston, Texas at 21 without a clue. And when I got there, I remember the summer before I left. You know how when you're about to leave town, everybody wants to take you out and have a party. I kind of had built a bit of a reputation that I wished I could have left behind. But evidently, by the time I got to Texas, so did the things that I did through the grapevine. And so the relationship that I had meant to have by the time I got there had already partially been destroyed by my drinking, which I thought was fun. This relationship, which was really all I had, broke up within about 4 months. I moved there in September, and I can remember going out with my new job, was an oil firm, and went out and, you know, we went to strip bars. Had never seen anybody take their clothes off in public, was a bit, you know, wild. But the biggest part of it was people were buying me drinks. And I thought, how cool is that? And I promised somebody I'd tell this, and I can't remember, I think it was Annie, that, you know, this was in the 80s. And so when you're drinking and you think you're having fun, it's important to look sexy. So in the 80s, I had these two pantsuits that I bought at Mervyn's because I went out to the discos. And you'd go out for drinks. And one pantsuit was a really nice little red thing with sleeves and, you know, the tight little belt that made you look skinny and your boobs bigger. And safety pins so you had cleavage. Really big heels with the straps around the ankles. I know what you call them, but I just thought they were sexy. And the Farrah Fawcett hairdo and the eyeshadow. And in the black pantsuit had red piping. And so that was much classier. Same kind of look with the belt and the, you know, pinned up. And because if you're in a hurry to get out to the bar, I actually used masking tape because it was always too long and I had to masking tape the hem so that I didn't drag on the ground and ruin my new pantsuits. So those were two of my party girl pantsuits. And, you know, I don't think I ever really learned how to disco. But I really thought I was good because a lot of people wanted to dance with me. I don't think they were looking to dance. I thought they were looking to have fun, which it looked like fun to me. And when you're intoxicated, I was the kind of girl that really just knew if I should say no, I didn't know how. A couple of reasons. I was too drunk. I was too afraid you'd reject me. And I was too afraid to look stupid. So I didn't say no. Half the times when I said I should. And the hard part about that is when the night is over and the morning comes and you did stuff you probably should have said no to, it feels like shit. You know, and I think that was where, looking back, that's where I started to see the destruction of alcoholism for myself. I didn't recognize it in my family. I didn't really recognize it with anybody else. I had never been worried about somebody else who got too drunk, even my sister and brother. I just didn't, it wasn't one of those things that we just paid attention to. You know, if you saw somebody too drunk at the bar, you laughed at them, you know, or you criticized them for not being able to hold their liquor. I was grateful that sometimes people would take care of me when I was too drunk. And that, in the long and short of it, living in Houston, Texas, as a single young woman, I never got harmed. That is a grace of God that I don't have a story where somebody harmed me. Because I put myself in plenty of positions to do that. Towards the end of my drinking, I had, damaged a relationship beyond repair, got into another one. I became the connection for Quaaludes at work. I was able to drink and do Quaaludes, probably not very successfully. In Texas, we used to call them mandrakes. Then there is the, in the 80s, then there's cocaine. And the thing about cocaine, because I never really liked stimulants, I always like the downer effect, but they helped you drink more. And it seemed like it was the thing to do. So, you know, I think that there was a good, from the time that I was probably 21 to 24, I had experience probably doing more drugs than my body or brain should have done. You know, and to this day, sometimes when I don't remember, I blame it on smoking too much pot. When I can't make decisions, I know that somewhere I've impaired myself, and those are my excuses, and I'm sticking to it. Mostly when I have to tell my kids that. My family today will laugh at me when they, you know, my kids are in school, so they learn all this stuff, and my husband is a really intelligent person with a real knack for history and reads Time magazine and all that. And so I'll ask a question about something I think I asked, I don't know if it was, you know, obviously I'll be embarrassed to say, what was Hubble? And they all go, you don't know? And I'm like, yeah, I don't. You know, I was smoking pot. You know, so, you know, I'm kind of the joke of my family, but today it's not as bad because I don't take myself so seriously, and who the fuck wants to know about the Hubble anyway? So, little ego there, doesn't hurt anybody. I get to, you know, have fun with myself and take a punch from my kids and my husband. I went to treatment because things got really bad. And the week before I went to treatment, I had really made some efforts to try to put my life together. Because when you're going to treatment somehow, when you've been unmanageable enough that your job is falling apart, your relationship is has problems, that somehow you have to try to put things in order before you go. Well, I couldn't even pack. I have pictures that I found some years ago when I was moving of literally hours before going to treatment, calling my dealer to get some cocaine. Then I remembered I took the Valium. Get some Valium so I could focus enough to get packed to go to treatment. I had a boyfriend that drove me to the airport, and I don't think he could drive fast enough to get me on that plane, mainly because I was out of control. I was a wreck. By the time I got to treatment, I weighed about 90 pounds. My hair was falling out. If I had food, I was throwing it up, and to keep from eating, I was doing cocaine, and alcohol and downers were the only thing that really felt like they brought me relief. So I was quite the mess. I had actually called, naturally, an ex-boyfriend to, I decided I'd fly. Treatment was in Naples. It's on the Gulf of Mexico. I decided to fly into Fort Lauderdale so I could just see him. On my way to treatment, I've got an agenda to see this guy, see if he still thinks I'm all that. on my way to treatment. So I call him, you know, how could the guy say no? Will you pick me up at the airport and take me to treatment? My life's a mess. So he says, okay. That's when we stopped and had the Long Island iced teas. And of course, he brought some pot for me to smoke. I was really grateful. Thought we'd rekindle a relationship. And when I got out, maybe we could see how things would go. And, you know, I mean, I really had some unmanageable thoughts. I had some really messed up thinking. So he gets me to this treatment center, and I literally picked a treatment center that had tennis courts, swimming pool. I was in Texas. I wanted to go to the beach. It was in Florida, so they would show the beach. So we pull up in front of this place. There's no beach, and I didn't see the horse stables. I was looking for that, too. I really, like I said, I had no idea that I was going to do drug treatment. I was going for eating disorders. I had bulimia. And honest to God, I really knew I had a bottom with bulimia. You know, I had been binging and purging over about 8 years and not able to stop. I was terribly ashamed of that. And I never really understood any of the substance use that I had that it was a problem. And I remember him pulling up in front, and I asked him, I said, listen, I tell you what, how about you drive me down the street, you leave me a couple joints and about $50, and I'll call him tomorrow to come get me. And I just thought this, I was going to change my mind. I didn't want to do this. You know, I didn't have a return plane ticket home. And he said, I don't think so. So I probably tried to talk him into coming with me, and he was thinking, you know what, I just came along for the ride. I'm going home. So I went into the treatment center, and that changed my life. I had a different experience than I had had. I think one of the things, in spite of not having all the amenities there, was that there were people there to truly help me because I was sick, and I didn't know. I kind of thought I was going to go and I'd be out in a couple weeks. It was an 8-week program, and I thought, you know, I'm pretty smart. I know what to do. I've had therapy, I should be able to nip this one pretty quick. I think they wanted to extend my stay by an extra 4 weeks by the time I got to six. But a couple of things that they had me to do was they wanted me to gain 15 pounds, which I thought was terribly scary, because if I gained weight, how would I look? They wanted me to start to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I really wasn't very clear about that because I really didn't see that alcohol was a problem. I knew cocaine was a problem, but I didn't understand alcohol being a problem. Then they tell you that it means all substances, and there goes the marijuana, which really, I think I wasn't going to tell them, but I was going to smoke when I left. And what I think was the most valuable experience there was to be a part of something that started to make sense. And really, it took me a couple weeks before I think the drugs were out of my system enough to start to understand what people were telling me. You know, there was group therapy, there was people confronting you, there was people talking to you about, you know, your manipulation. I had to do the first step. I hadn't a clue what powerlessness meant. What I mostly remember that was really helpful was they would have a speakers meeting at the treatment center. And there were most of the people go to the speakers meeting, but there in this small group room, there was a small big book study. And I was too fidgety to sit in and listen to somebody. I just couldn't sit still. And I went into this small group, and it was probably about 7 or 8 people, and mostly of them were middle-aged men. And they came to this treatment to do service. And they started to just help me sit still. And they read to me out of the big book. And I was not really grasping what they were saying. But what I remembered is that there was kindness and there was some compassion, and somehow it felt like I was able to finally sit still and not have to think about everything that I felt so insecure about for a short period of time. And by the time I left that treatment center, I had gone to Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Cocaine Anonymous, Adult Children of Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't know, Overeaters Anonymous. So I had like five different programs that, you know, my treatment plan, they give you a treatment plan when you leave treatment, going to meetings. And so when they encouraged me to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, that wasn't a problem because I had to get to every single one of those meetings. And, you know, five out of seven, you were going to at least hit two in the same time. Plus, I tried women for sobriety, but they were 2 hours long and that sucked. So I managed to, in Houston, for the first year of my sobriety, go to a meeting every single day. Now, I don't have any idea how I really did that, because if you told me today that I had to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, I'd tell you, I don't think so. For the only thing that I know to be true is that there was something that was working for me that absolutely I wouldn't have done for myself. One of the turning points for me was about a month after I got out of treatment. I was supposed to go home and live with my sister, who was still using. And, of course, I thought, you know, it'll be okay. I'll help her get clean and sober. We'll be fine. Well, it didn't work out so much that way. She was a mess. She was actually hooking up with my old dealer, my old boyfriend, and it wasn't, she wanted to move out. Why the hell would she want to be around somebody who's getting clean and sober? And so I ended up getting an apartment on my own. And at that time, actually I think we were still living together, I was going to experience my first Christmas sober. And I asked my dad to come out to Houston to spend the Christmas with us because I really didn't know how to do that. I had no idea what I was going to do. So he came out and he spent Christmas with us, and the point that I missed is that my person had, the guy that I dated that I left when I went to treatment, and fortunately didn't hook back up with, died of an overdose a month after I was out of treatment. And I think for me, that was the grace of God. It may have been for him too, because I don't know what his life would have been like. What I know is that my other addiction, sixth addiction, was to men, was to try to fix him up so that the two of us could live happily ever after, once I got rid of his other girlfriend. And it didn't work that way. What I have to tell you is that tragedy kept me sober. Because there was a rude awakening for me. And the thing that I had been told is that people like us die from this disease. And I had said it. I had even said it to him because I had kind of been programmed to do that. And I had started on this path of going to meetings that I started to hear that this disease would kill us. And when it happened in real life for me, it was one of those things that I experienced in the most profound way. So after he died, I clung to the program. And I clung to people who helped me stay sober through a difficult time because it was a pretty terrific loss. And then after that, watching my sister go to treatment. So a lot was happening that first year of sobriety. Then comes the good part. This is kind of in the middle. Well, there's this cute guy from Utah who's going to meetings in Houston. And I'm not wearing the disco outfits anymore, but I still got the Farrah Fawcett hairdo, and I'm still, you know, self-esteem. I'm pretty addicted to you thinking I'm really cute, and he did. And so the story goes that we went out the night before he was leaving to move to Hawaii, I think he was coming back to Utah, decided not to go to Hawaii, and asked me to come visit him in Utah. And I, you know, was smitten. You know, I found this guy who's in AA, thinks I'm darling, and what an adventure to go to another state. And because he asked me. I mean, no agenda. I mean, I no agenda about, is this the smart thing to do? Is this a stupid thing to do? And of course, I did have a sponsor, but I didn't want to ask her at the time. So, because you know they'll say no. So why do you want to ask somebody who's going to tell you no? I mean, I'm staying sober, I'm going to meetings, but I'm going to go on this trip with this guy, and it's not a bad idea because he's in the program. So I go to Utah and spend the weekend with him. We drove up to Snowbird. And if you're a person who's easily wowed, it was like mountains. I've been living in Texas for 5 years, and he thinks I'm darling, and he takes me on a motorcycle ride, and da-da-da-da-da. You know, it's all great. So at the end of the weekend, we decide to get married. And, you know, and I'm just like, God, of course nobody had ever asked me to get married him, so you don't turn down the first offer. So I go back to Texas, and we're trying to figure this out. So he decides to move down there. This is a guy who is an early recovering alcoholic cocaine addict. Didn't even ask that information. I just knew he was in the program. So he switches his life from his geographic to Hawaii to Houston, Texas, with no job, his guitar, and his perfect infatuation with me. I'm okay. So a month later, he's miserable and needs to get out of there. So the marriage is off. I think he comes back to Utah. We have one. I come to Utah. We decide to kind of give it another shot. I come up here for a weekend. I think we went to Boulder Mountain. And if you're on top of a mountain in a tent and somebody just adores you and they ask you to marry him again, what do you say? So, but this time, we're going to try it where I move to Utah. So, lock, stock, and barrel, I'm moving to Utah, and I did. And literally, I knew this guy 2 weekends in 1 month. Now, mind you, that month didn't go very well, but the 2 weekends were fabulous. So, if I can have a marriage like that, I'm hooked. So, the gratitude in it is I'm still here in Utah. The long and the short of that is we after about 2 years, he wasn't that interested in AA anymore, and he was struggling with some other issues, and I was totally into AA. Not only that, I was going to school to be a drug and alcohol counselor. That's what every good new sober person does. They go to school to be a drug and alcohol counselor because I found my passion. And that's not a lie. That was really what I did. However, when you have a newly found drug and alcohol counselor living in your home and you're deciding not to go to Alcoholics Anonymous anymore, it really sucked for him. And so it got to the point where he had decided he needed to go to California to work and I could move in with his parents. Well, I wasn't going for the living with your parents part. He went to California, and I think the grace of God helped us figure out that it probably wasn't a good idea for us to stay married anymore. And so here I was going through a divorce after about 2.5 years married, about 2 years married. I had only been a year sober when I got married. And mind you, when I came to Utah to get sober, I went to meetings, and a couple women who I still know today asked me to an aftercare. So I had 3 people in my family at the wedding. And, you know, I don't even know what I was thinking. It's like I just kind of went with, you know, what I should do. My sponsor in Texas told me I should follow through with my commitments. I wish I, at that point, had a different sponsor. But she was helping keep me sober. She maybe didn't know the best plan for me. Anyway, after the divorce, I found myself here in Utah, but I want to tell you, not alone. And I wasn't alone because I did have Alcoholics Anonymous. I already had a sponsor. I had people here that I went to the Alano Club, the women's 10 o'clock meeting. I met Betty there. I met Becky there. There's people in this room that saw me come in from Texas looking all cute. And watched me go through a divorce and watched me not drink. And when I got here, I still went to meetings. I had been one of those people. I was single. I didn't have a family, and I did have a job. And what I knew to work was to go to a meeting every day and to work with others. And I remember sponsoring women a lot. Oh, God help me, those poor women. I don't know. I was very enthusiastic about sponsoring them, but I don't think I really had a good grasp on how to be a sponsor. I was just doing my best to kind of follow along with what people told me. But the important part of it was is that I really did cling to Alcoholics Anonymous. What I found here is that I didn't really much connect to Cocaine Anonymous. There wasn't a lot of Narcotics Anonymous going on at the time. I guess this was in 86, at least the meetings that I found. I didn't like Overeaters Anonymous. I had a sponsor that was helping me with the eating disorder, which I had actually been slipping on. Imagine that, going through divorce. I wasn't picking up a drug, so I was going to throw up. So that was something I had to contend with. But after the divorce, I got support. I want to say that relationships were not something I was able to, people say stay out of a relationship for the first year of sobriety. I don't understand that because I never did it. Let me put it this way. I understand it, but I just never did it that way. And then they tell you when you go to get a divorce, you should take some time to, you know yourself. Well, I actually decided to get a divorce after I started a new relationship. In the separation phase, you figure if he's not there, then by God, I'm not going to be alone. And I think that that's mostly what I was always looking for relief from, which was that lonely feeling that I felt when I had to be by myself, with myself, and looking at myself. I always felt much better if you looked at me and thought I was pretty, you thought I was sweet, you thought I was sexy. And if that wasn't there, then I was looking for something else to fill it up. I had actually been hanging out with a couple different prospects, you could say. And I can't tell you I was deliberately doing this. I was kind of looking for that attention. I was looking for somebody to make me feel okay because one person was leaving. And for me, I had I'd been a kid of divorce. I didn't want to screw up a marriage. I didn't want to be the person who got a divorce. But it was clear to me that this was happening. And I had a couple people that I went out with. And then I had a friendship date with my current husband. I didn't, for the first time, I think, have an agenda because I thought he wasn't my type. Shows you how much I know. He was just a friend, but he was a friend who genuinely had enough care and concern about me to be there when I was going through a difficult time. And it wasn't just him, it was other women. A lot of other women helped me. That turned into a relationship of 20 years. Two, 3 weeks from now, I will have been married 18 years successfully. And what I can tell you is that is about the middle of my sobriety, and that's what it's like now, is that I don't even know what time it is. Do you have a clock?
Yeah.
Where am I? Oh, I'm doing okay. So I probably talked more about the past than I wanted to, but what I do know to be true today is that I still have those ideas about how I think things should be in my life. If I were to tell you anything, and those of you that might be new, and there's several people here, is that I really did not have a clue when I got here. I had a lot of garbage. I had a lot of things that were not perceived to be trouble of my own making. And I had to learn how to look at that differently. I had to learn about something that was not clear to me. One of the things was I was an alcoholic. And I really didn't understand what that meant. All I knew is my life was a mess and I wanted it to be different. And I would try every which way I could to make it different. Even did that in early sobriety by getting married, moving to Utah, la-di-da. What I think I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous was really about the true meaning of being powerless over alcohol. That I did realize that I didn't want to be a mess anymore. I didn't want to feel ashamed and embarrassed about things that I did after I had been drinking. I didn't want to have to go to sleep thinking that I took too much of something that I might not wake up in the morning. And I didn't want to hate myself anymore. And I think it took about 2 years in Alcoholics Anonymous before I truly started being able to look in the mirror and not hate myself anymore. Because most of it had been superficial. It had been what I looked like on the outside. I think the first 3 years of Alcoholics Anonymous was really truly about learning about just step one. You know, I went through the steps, you know, my first year of sobriety with my sponsor, but I truly don't think I really grasped what step one meant. I knew life was unmanageable. That was a given. But that powerlessness was something I had to learn a lot about. As I start to think about that, that part of, I think, what we talk about in steps one, two, and three was really surrendering to not do something the way that you would normally do it. And that, you know, of course, as AA talks about, is a relationship with God. Now, I didn't have any relationship with God. I kind of grew up with some dysfunctional Catholics who, you know, their geographic was, let's leave the Catholic Church because they're screwed up. And who knows what my parents were thinking. I can remember they pulled me out of Catholic school in the third grade. And I thought my life was over because I had to go from a Catholic school to a public school. And so my parents' dysfunction in their faith and spirituality basically just left me kind of roadless. I didn't have that concept of a higher power. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, there was at least some information by way of the Big Book and by the way of other people sharing about what that meant for them that helped me start to define what that would be for me. I had to learn it real simply, like coming to believe in a power greater than myself. My first time that I figured that out was when I was in an airport waiting to go from treatment to Houston, and I found a keychain in a little basket at the gift counter waiting for my airplane, scared to death, and it had my name on it. It said Mary Jo. And it was upright with a little rainbow on it, and I'm like, guess what? This has got my name on it. Oh, my God. Nothing ever has the name Mary Jo on it. And oh, my God. And I started to talk about my story to this person in the gift shop who's looking at me like, okay, are you ready to buy the keychain or what, you know? But I tell that because that was really something tangible that I needed to confirm that there was something more powerful than me that would help me be okay rather than grasping to something that was, you know, going to help me escape. And it was small. There were other things along the way that helped me believe in a power greater than myself. They were things like my rent getting paid when I wasn't sure how I was going to be able to afford it on my own. It was, how am I going to make it now that I'm in Utah and my husband's divorced? He actually came and got all the furniture and TV set. You know, you'd be pissed too if you found out, you know, the woman you were separated from just hooked up with somebody else. My reasoning was that, you know, we were going to get divorced. But things fell into place. And I think that that's why, for me, coming to believe in a power greater than myself has been so profound for me. Because I really had a blank slate. Turning my will and my life over, oh God, I'm still working on it. What I can tell you is I don't much know how to do that all the time, but I take myself to places where I can have a script. That's the third step prayer and the 11th step prayer. One of the things I did in early sobriety is I wrote on my mirror in red lipstick, because I love drama, "Thy will, not mine, be done." And I didn't really know what it meant. I had to learn what it meant. And I had to have people explain it to me. And I had to have sponsors help me identify it each time I bumped up against it. And what I did was, I think, Betty, you were one of the people that helped me read the third step prayer every day. At that time, I think I was about 4 years sober. I was in a new relationship. I had actually a second marriage. And still trying to find my way the way I think I should do it. And that is the reason for having a sponsor or somebody who can help you, maybe not do it your way, but help you out as you're finding your way. And I've had people in my life who have done that every day since I entered Alcoholics Anonymous. People that have helped me learn how to do the steps, help me learn about how to have relationships with other people, which is probably the most challenging thing to do. I'm the kind of person who thinks I have the best idea and thinks I have plenty of experience to back that up. The truth is I just want to have it my way, because if I do it your way, it won't be so comfortable for me. And I have to constantly kind of bump up against that. Something that I get to work on constantly, and I think we do in AA, is having a way that we can constantly look at the parts of ourselves that we're so uncomfortable with. You know, I did a lot of stuff in my using days that I was really ashamed of, things that I already told somebody, and so I wouldn't repeat them from the podium. And I don't feel awful about myself because of those things. I get to have that freedom from that guilt and shame that I experienced when I did those things. And the people who let me tell them those things just listened. They didn't tell me how to fix it. They didn't tell me whether I should have or shouldn't done it. What they did is they helped me say, what was your part? And then I was able to kind of be free from the ugly part of it and have some support to learn how to do it differently as I continued to live my life. The thing that I think has been most important for me is a sense of belonging. And I don't think I could have continued to be somebody who could belong to Alcoholics Anonymous if I hadn't contributed to Alcoholics Anonymous. Service is one of the biggest things that I think helps us stay sober. I'm not a service junkie, but part of what I do every day in my life is being of service. I definitely do it as my job. That part of me that was so fortunate to become a drug and alcohol counselor 22 years ago, is still a drug and alcohol counselor. And I truly think that that's grace for me. Being a drug and alcohol counselor didn't keep me sober, because a lot of what I get to see every day is working with the sick part of it, is the illness, and it devastates lives, and it takes the best part of us away, that part of us that finds that light inside of us, or that part of us that feels like we matter somewhere, not just to ourselves, but maybe to somebody else. And I feel very fortunate that I get to be a part of people beginning to open the door to their own light, to their own self-forgiveness, to their own journey, whatever that may be. For me, it was Alcoholics Anonymous. I have to tell you, over 23 and a half years, some meetings, I've had home groups. After about 8 years, my first home group here, I got really bored. I just thought, I can't listen to one more person in that meeting tell the same story. And I started to lose that part of me that felt grateful. And I fortunately had a sponsor that said, you know what, Mary Jo, it's just time to change your meeting. Go to a different meeting. But don't drop Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't think I ever really thought that Alcoholics Anonymous was my problem. I know that part of what happens is I get in a funk. We get stuck. Our human condition is just, we're going to come up with obstacles. We're going to come up with challenges. And I don't know that Alcoholics Anonymous has the answer to everything. But what I do absolutely know is it's one of the things, I think Kelsey said it, it's one of the first things that I check into. I make sure that I still am connecting with going to a meeting. You know, I don't always get to a meeting more than one a week. I prefer to, but I have my home group. And every time I get to sit down in my chair at my home group, I feel like somewhere in my week that I have a piece of my own sanity. I feel like I belong. And I truly get to be grateful for being sober, because there's usually somebody else in the room who doesn't get to be as fortunate as I am on that day. This last week I was at a meeting and I heard about a guy who came from prison. And the look in his eyes and the sense of what he must be going through was profound. Because there was a lot of us talking in the meeting about some pretty damn good problems. You know, kids graduating from college, ex-husbands, you know, having to deal with them, and, you know, just normal stuff, you know. And I thought about this person who didn't have a home but did have his sobriety. And for him, what I got was that it didn't matter, that the most important thing for him is to be sober and that he was sitting at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And it's kind of like everything else that you think about that's self-centered goes away, you know. And I'll tell you, I am a self-centered person through and through. You know, the kids didn't clean the house. My arms look like old lady arms. I have spots on my legs. I don't like what I'm wearing. I have, you know, I don't like my haircut, blah, you know. I mean, whatever it is, you know, I wish I had a different car. I was complaining to my husband the other morning, who's my boss, that I hadn't had a raise in 2 years. And and he said, neither have I. And I said, I guess I'm just grateful to have my job, aren't I? And I truly meant it, you know. You need to know that having your husband for your boss is not an easy thing. He's tougher on you than any of the other employees. Special favors don't work. But, you know, I think a lot of what's come down for me day after day, being a sober woman in Alcoholics Anonymous, being a sober person among the members of Alcoholics Anonymous, is I do have something that is very significant in my life. My daughter went to camp this week. It's a diversity camp. And she said, you know, Mom, you know, I don't know what I have to offer. You have to bring something about your heritage. And she was really struggling to find a sense of what we had as a tradition in our family. And, you know, we actually have, I think, you know, different things that we do as a tradition, but one of the most profound things that I think we've offered her is a family that's in recovery. Her mom and dad she's never seen drunk. Neither of my daughters. I have a 13-year-old almost and a 15-year-old, and neither of them have seen us drunk. And she said, you know, I'm just kind of this normal white kid with a good family, you know. And I have to tell you, thank you, because that's because of Alcoholics Anonymous. My kids see me lose it. They know I have a potty mouth. I mean, I think as she forgot her towels on the way to camp, and I said, fuck, I told you to check the list. How come you didn't take the pen and check the list? You know, I mean, I'm being an asshole, you know? And she, you could just see her think, oh, great, you know, here she goes again, you know? You know, I still act like a jerk. I catch myself, you know, and as, of course, that came out, I think, here's your kid going away to camp, you know, and you're acting like an asshole. You better remedy it right now, you know? That's about taking my inventory. That's step 10. And every day, I get to do that. And I wouldn't be reminded to do that if I wasn't in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I can tell you, from your first day sober to the first year sober to the next year sober, if you continue to come to the meetings and you continue to talk to some people, you work with others, you help them find their way sober, you can do anything without picking up a drink. A good friend of mine says, you gotta want to be sober more than you want to get drunk. And I absolutely know that. I don't want to be drunk. I'd like to taste alcohol. I'd like to smoke a joint. I'd like that. What can I say? I'm a person who would like to get high. I absolutely know that. So see, it doesn't matter what I would do. I hear people kind of split hairs with whether it's cocaine or heroin or alcohol or whatever it is. And to me, I absolutely know that it doesn't matter, because I'm a person with this desire to want to change how I feel. And what I know is that I've chosen a road to not do that. And the outcome has been much better. Some days it's really hard. Some days it is more challenging than I can tell you. But what I absolutely know is on the other side of it, I absolutely feel like I have had the best road I could have ever chosen. And I know that that wasn't my own doing. I have a full life today. I do have a healthy family. I do say I'm sorry when I've been wrong. I constantly am looking for something. You know, this is the last thing I'll say. When we read the list about everything that we had tried to get sober, well, one I want to tell you is I've tried all those things in sobriety. looking for spirituality. Okay, aerobics wasn't about looking for spirituality, but, and I stopped doing that too. I'm into yoga, which actually has helped me find a way to connect to that part of me that I keep trying to run from, which is sit still, just listen, and for a little bit, feel that sense of not having to fill it up with anything. And so for me, the journey really has been a spiritual one. I talk to a higher power frequently. Sometimes I call it God. Sometimes I don't know what I'm talking to. What I do know is that I trust that it's there for me, and it helps me to be okay. Helps me on Monday morning when I'm feeling anxious to go to work. It helps me to know that tomorrow when I have an audit from the county, that even if they are critical of my work, I'm not a failure. It helps me to know that if my husband's angry at me, we can work it out. It helps me to know that when I've acted like an asshole in front of my children, that I'm still lovable and I'm still a good mother. It helps me to know that even when I've made a grave mistake, that I can do something to change how I made the mistake so that I can make it better. I'm somebody who believes that I'm not going to give up trying. And I learned that here. I love my life. I love being a sober woman. I am so grateful for everything that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. As I came in tonight, I've not been to this meeting before, but there are literally a dozen people that, probably 15, that have been dear people in my life for the past 20 years. And I can tell you today, I don't currently have a sponsor. I have a step sponsor. She's an evil step sponsor. She helps me go through things when I need to get right-sized. And what I have are lots of people that I call on a daily basis. A day doesn't go by where I'm not talking to two or three or four alcoholics, whether I sponsor them or they're sponsoring me. It's a two-way street. And I wouldn't do it any other way. Thanks.